Parsha Vayera begins with a famous episode of Achnosas Orchim of Avraham Avinu. He sees these three men in the distance, and even though he's under great distress himself, he gives them the royal treatment. And indeed, this was an act that bore fruit for the Jewish people, as we mentioned, the Gemara and Bar Metzia. We mentioned last week that in the merit of giving them to drink, his descendants received water, and the merit of giving them food, his descendants received food, and the merit of giving them shade, his descendants received shade. It was considered a great act all round. And there's an interesting maisa which happened, which sheds light on this story of Avraham Avinu. The Beis Halevi, or Rosh HaBeis Soloveitchik, was traveling, as he sometimes had to do. And when he traveled, he didn't wear the rabbinic garb. He was, at the time, the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin. But when he traveled, no need to advertise, and he dressed like a normal Jew. So he checks in to an inn, to a hotel. And the owner of the inn takes one look at this Alter Yid, not very hopeful in terms of just how much of a tip he thinks he'll get from him, and doesn't exactly treat him in the best way. He gives him second-class treatment. He makes him wait and puts him in the corner and doesn't give him such a good room. And, of course, the Beis Halevi is not complaining. He's not there for luxury. But within the course of the evening, as Rabbi Yosher Ber sits down and he's having his supper, people recognize him. And slowly but surely, word gets round. It's the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin is staying in this inn. Well, when the owner of the inn heard that the person that he had mistreated is none other than Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, he was mortified. And he rushes over to the Beis Halevi to apologize. Says, I have to apologize to the Rosh Hashiva. So the Beis Halevi says, no, you don't. So the innkeeper said, well, I do. I mean, I treated you very badly. So the Beis Halevi said, no, you don't. So, I mean, the innkeeper asked, well, why not? I mean, why don't I need to ask you Mechila from the Rosh Hashiva? So the Beis Halevi says, because you didn't do anything wrong to the Rosh Hashiva. You didn't mistreat the Rosh Hashiva. You mistreated Yosher Ber Soloveitchik. As soon as you knew that I was the Rosh Hashiva, so it was star treatment. So there's no point apologizing to the Rosh Hashiva because you were just fine with him. But with Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, the simple Jew, he's the one that you mistreated, and he's the one that you need to apologize to. And he mentioned, by way of illustration, we find there are actually two acts, really, of Achnasas Orchim in Parshas Vayera. There is the much celebrated act of Avraham Avinu in the beginning of Vayera, and we find nothing but praise, and it's considered now an outstanding deed. Later on in the Parsha, we find that Lot also acquits himself rather well with regards to Achnasas Orchim. He puts himself out a great deal. He seems even puts his life at risk for Achnasas Orchim. Somehow, that isn't really celebrated so much. That isn't praised so highly. In fact, when Chazal discussed in the Medrash if was there any merit for Lot that he was saved from Sodom, anything at all, so the Medrash says when Avraham Avinu said that Sarai was his sister and he was her brother, so Lot kept quiet. That's pretty much as far as he goes. What about this act of Achnasas Orchim? Says Beis Halevi, the distinction between them is very simple. Avraham Avinu performed an act of hospitality for people that are described in the Pasuk as Vihinei Shlosha Anoshim. Who were they? They were nobodies. I mean, they looked like they were just Arabs lost in the midday heat. No people of distinction. By the time they come to Sodom, they're no longer called Anoshim. The Pasuk says, Vayavoshne Hamalochim Sodom, and Lot sees them as Malochim. The Beis Halevi says, to extend hospitality To Malachim, that's not a great gedula. To extend hospitality and give special treatment to nobody, to some people, that's what's outstanding about the Achnasas Orchim of Avraham Avinu. And therefore he chided the innkeeper that don't save your preferential treatment only for the Rosh Hashiva, but even for the normal person. That's true Achnasas Orchim. Indeed, it's very interesting to note, it's not only is this difference between them, for Avram they were Anoshim, they were men, and for Lot they were Malochim, they were angels, but Lot actually tries to use this for his defense. And ultimately he comes to defend himself against the people of Sodom. We find in Perek Yud Tes, Pasuk Ches. So Lot has committed a terrible crime. He's invited people into his house. And the people of Sodom, they demand justice. So they surround the house and they demand these people be thrown out of the house. Now Lot comes out. His beginning is a little shaky because he offers them his daughters, and that itself needs to be understood. But towards the end of the pasuk, he says, "Rak la anashim ha'el al tasu davar." But don't, please don't hurt these people, because they're my guests. Now, we note that he refers to them as ha'anashim ha'el. What is the meaning of the word ha'el? It's very close, and I think we would normally translate it as ha'ele. It's essentially another way of saying ha'ele. And in fact, Rashi says ha'el is kumo ha'ele. However, another Mefarshim nonetheless note that, or persist, and the pasuk doesn't say ha'ela, it does say ha'el. Are they exactly the same? And the people of Sodom are upset. Vayomru, they say, gesh hala. Move away, they say to him. Vayomru ha'echad balagor v'yishpot shafot. What, this person, he comes to sojourn amongst us and he's judging? Now that's a very interesting question. It's clearly a rhetorical statement. He is judging? Because if you look in Rashi, in the beginning of the Perek, he was judging. And in fact, he was appointed as a judge by none other than the people of Sodom. He's sitting by the gate of Sodom. That's where the judges sit. Pasuk says, Vayavo shnei amalochim Sodoma va'erev, Pasuk Aleph of Perek Yotes, Velot Yoshev Bishar Sodom. He's sitting by the gate. What's he doing sitting by the gate? Judges sit by the gate. Rashi says, Osu ayom minu shofet aleihem. On that day, they appointed him as a judge. So they can hardly be incredulous that he's judging. I mean, that's his job. And they gave it to him. So why are they so scandalized by the fact that Lot is doing the job that they appointed him to do? Says the Ksava Kabbalah, the sin of Lot here, this terrible wrongdoing, he committed the felony of hospitality. He invited people into his house. Now that was illegal in Sodom. Why? Why did they make it such a crime? We know that originally this area, Sodom and Amora, we see from in last week's parsha, Lot looks upon it and it's fantastic. It's very fertile. It's abundant in natural resources. That's exactly why they closed it off to other people. They didn't want people taking. I mean, their bracha became their worst curse, because their wealth was something they protected so zealously. They didn't want to share it with anyone. And slowly but surely it gained momentum to the extent that no guests were allowed in, lest chas v'shalom they divert some of their resources. Now, if that's true, so Lot raises an interesting point. Isn't it reasonable that if the basis of outlawing, inviting people in, is that they may drain the resources, but what about inviting powerful people in? What about inviting people who may actually be an asset, who may gain? We may gain from them. Doesn't that make sense, that those are for the very basis of this legislation should determine that these are people that we should welcome? And that's why he says, Rak la'anashim ha'el. The word ha'el in Lashon HaKodesh, el means strong. Eile Haaretz, Loshen Chozek, says Rashi. And that's really what the Lotus is saying. He isn't just saying, please don't harm these people. Why wouldn't they harm them? He's saying, La'anashim, these are strong people. These are not the sort of people you want to harm. This is counterintuitive to the reason why these laws were set up. So Lot is actually drawing on the powerful stature, the great bearing of these guests as a way of defending them and defending himself. And that's what upset the people of Sodom. Because they appointed him to become a judge, but they did not appoint him to critique the legislation of Sodom. They appointed him to adjudicate based on that legislation. But as soon as he begins to judge the constitution itself, well, that's something they're not prepared to hear. And that's why they say, Vayomu in Pasuk Tes, Ha'echad balagur vayishpot shafot. He judges judging. That's the double expression, vayishpot shafot. They have no problem with him judging. But when he begins to judge the judging, that is to say, he begins to examine the constitution, which they worked so hard to set up and are guarding so zealously, that's something they're not prepared to hear. And what's very terrifying about this response of the people of Sodom is that we see that the constitution had taken on a life of its own, because even as it now undermines the original reason, they're no longer protecting their assets because they could gain by these people, but the constitution needs to be protected at all costs. It's essentially the antithesis of the idea of low plug. We don't make differentiations. And the reason why is, you can hear the moral outrage of the people of Sodom. If we make one exception, who knows where it will lead? If we invite in rich people, we may come in the fullness of time to invite middle-class people. And ultimately, maybe even the poor. So this, it can't begin. This sort of thing threatens the very fabric of our constitution. You can hear such a... It's a derabonon. And you can hear they're guarding. They're making a siyag for the constitution of Sodom. And at that point, they're beyond salvage, because they can't even hear reason where it's to their benefit. And that, in a sense, sealed the fate of the people of Sodom. So this was Lot's defense. He's not merely saying, please, turn a blind eye to my felony of hospitality. He's saying, this is in our interest. But the people of Sodom weren't hearing it. And therefore, these cities of Sodom and Amorah, etc., they're slated to be destroyed. And let us take a look, actually, at the tefillah of Avram for these cities, because Avram davens extensively for them. And that is in Perek Yudches, as Avram approaches. Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Vayigash Avraham. He approaches and begins to talk, and then really the next 10 or so psukim, it's a lot. It's the longest conversation we have between Avram and anyone is between him and Hashem, trying to bargain for the salvation of these cities. It's quite something. What we should note is that there seems to be something of an oscillation with regards to what exactly Avram is davening for. And what does he want? And by that we mean, and we see it very rapidly, it shifts three times within four psukim. In Pasuk Kaf Gimel, who is he looking to save? Pasuk Kaf Gimel states, Vayigash Avraham Vayomar, Ha'af Tispet Tzadik Im Rasha, or will you destroy the Tzadik with the Rasha? So based on this opening statement from Avram, it sounds like what he finds objectionable and what he's looking perhaps to counteract is that the tzaddikim, if there are any, shouldn't be killed together with the rishayim. As long as they aren't, Avram doesn't seem to have a problem with the rishayim being destroyed, but it's just what tzaddikim rasha? That can't be. But the very next pasuk, Ula yesh chamishim tzadikim besoch ha'ir, perhaps if there's 50 tzadikim, ha'aftisbev lo tisa lamakom, will you not save the entire place? Leman chamishim atzadikim asher bekirba. So we see that from the first pasuk to the second, he's no longer just davening that the tzadikim shouldn't die together with the rishayim, implying that if the rishayim themselves are destroyed, that's acceptable, but he's actually davening that the rishayim should be saved along with the tzadikim, that no one should be destroyed. Okay, that's a shift in goal. But then, Pasuk Kafhei, Chalila Lacham Yasos Kedavar Hazeh, but how could you do this? Lahamis Tzadik in Russia. How could you kill the Tzadik with the Russia? Which goes back again to the opening play. That you can't kill a Tzadik with a Russia, implying that as long as you don't kill a Tzadik with a Russia, just the Russia, that's okay. And Hashem's response in Pasuk Kavav, Bayem Hashem in Mitzah B'Stom Chamishim Tzadikim B'Socha Eir V'Nasasi L'Chalamakom Ba'Avura. There's 50 Tzadikim, I'll save the entire place. So it goes back and forth from Pasuk to Pasuk. Number one, don't kill the Tzadikim with the Risharim. Number two, save the Risharim along with the Tzadikim. Number three, how could you kill the Tzadikim with the Risharim? And number four, I'll save the Risharim along with the Tzadikim. So what exactly does Avram want? What is his tefillah about? So what's interesting is, the key to all of this, and this is to be found in the commentary of the Taz, Rabbi David Halevi, in his Sefer Divrei David on Rashi, from the words, the opening words in Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Vayigash Avraham Vayomar, Avraham approaches. Now what is the meaning of approaches, especially as he's still there? The very words that came before Vayigash is Avraham Odenu Amed Lefnei Hashem. So he's standing before Hashem. If he's standing before Hashem, how can he approach? And what does it mean to approach? He's there. So Vayigash clearly is a preparation of sorts. But what is he preparing for? Says Rashi, Matsinu Hagosha. We find the term Hagosha, Vayigash, La Milchama, with war, in a connotation of war, Vayigash Yoav, Hagosha Lapius, Vayigash to appease, Vayigash Lav Yehuda, and Hagosha Litfila, Vayigash Eliyo Hanavi. So Vayigash is a very laden expression. It's approaching for all manner of things. And all of them exist within this original approach of Avram. Ulekol Eila Nichnas Avraham. Ledaber Koshos, Ulefios, Uletfila. He's going to be talking harshly. He's going to be appeasing. He's going to be davening. He's going to be doing all sorts of things. All of these three things. Says the Taz. Where do we see that? In other words, there seems to be, you know, this tefillah. How do we see war? Where is Davar Koshos? Where do we see appeasement? Where do we see tefillah? Says the Divrei David, this is the key to open up the psukim. Because Avram is actually doing two things at the same time. On the one hand, he is lodging a complaint, so to speak, that something isn't right about what's about to happen. That's one aspect of what he's doing. Namely, the aspect of how could you kill the tzaddikim together with the Rishayim. That's not tefillah. He's not praying that the tzaddikim should be saved. He doesn't sound like he's praying. He sounds like he's complaining. He sounds like he's charging. Because he says, well, how could you do that? What, ha'af dispet tzaddik in Russia? Are you really going to do that? Prayers don't sound like that. Are you really not going to grant my prayer? I mean, that's not how you daven. And therefore, you find the harsh aspect of Vayigash, the legal aspect, is saying, at the very least, don't kill tzaddikim. And I haven't even started davening yet. The tefillah begins in the next pasuk. Ulai, perhaps, if there's enough tzaddikim, then maybe you could save the Rishayim. Now, I'm not saying that has to be. That's what my tefillah has already begun by now. But then he goes back, Chalila lecha, the fallback position, at the very least, the tzaddikim shouldn't be killed. We're back again to Dovrei Koshos. Chalila lecha, how could you do that? And then in the final pasuk, Hashem says that he will save all of the city on behalf of the tzaddikim. That's Hashem answering Avram's prayer. So actually, if you open these psukim up, we see there's different currents running through them. Some of them are claims, some of them are entreaties, some of them are prayers. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds to each one. It's very interesting to note on this. It's quite a striking expression, Pasuk Kafei, Chalila Lecha. We would normally say Chalila to each other. No one says Chalila to Hashem. But Avram says Chalila Lecha, Mi'asos Kadavar Hazeh. What is the meaning of Chalila Lecha? It certainly doesn't mean heaven forbid. Avram is talking to heaven. And the Gemara comments on the expression Chalila Lecha. Rashi quotes it. The Gemara says that Chalila is an expression of Chulin. Chulin Hu Lecha. To kill the tzaddikim together with the Risharim would be an act, would be chulin. Now, what is the meaning of the word chulin? Why does that characterize if the tzaddikim will die together with the Risharim? So I think we understand that chulin we would translate perhaps as profane in a very negative way. But chulin actually means mundane. What does that mean, that it would be a mundane act? So the Chasam Sofer explains that so far there have been two scenarios that Avram is davening about. Namely, that the tzaddikim shouldn't die with the Rishayim, and perhaps even the Rishayim should be saved them, you know, together with the tzaddikim. Is there any other alternative? Is it ever fair, or does it ever happen for any reason that the tzaddikim would die? We do find in a few places in the Talmud that sometimes the tzaddikim, they die and they are a kapara for the generation. Misa tzaddikim mechaperes. And that's the juxtaposition of Misa tzaddikim to korbanos. Just like korbanos are mechaper, so to Misa tzaddikim is mechaper. And perhaps that might be what happens. It says Chasam Sofer, that's why Avram says, but if that's why the tzaddikim would die as a kapara, then there's no way that the tzaddikim could die together with the Rishayim. Because then who was the kapara for? It was the only way that it could possibly work is if there are any tzaddikim there, if they would die, that would be a kapara for everybody else. But if the people that received the kapara die also, so then the kapara went to waste. And that's what chulin is. Chulin is an unrealized korban. The opposite number to chulin is hekdesh. Hekdesh, something that's sanctified, like a sacrifice. So if the tzaddikim are the korban, they're only an actual korban, at least if the Rishayim are saved. But if the tzaddikim die along with the Rishayim, so then that's chulin, that's a korban unrealized, gone to waste. That's the expression of chulin hulach. So says Chasam Sofer. So Avram is davening extensively. And Reb Shimon Schwab asked a very interesting question. How does Avram know that he's allowed to daven for this? As if to say, what is the standard reaction to HaKadosh Baruch Hu informing him of something like this? Does he know that he's meant to argue back? Is he meant to plead for it to be rescinded? And the question becomes all the more accentuated when we consider that later on in the Parsha, Hashem says to Avram, take your son and offer him as a korban. And Avram does it. That would be a point, perhaps, that Avram might have wanted to daven. Or to ask. Maybe even to complain. Could that be? Is that right? He's a tzaddik. He didn't do anything wrong. But he just accepts it. Because apparently, if Hashem says something is meant to happen, then that's what's meant to happen, and you can't reverse it. But when it came to Sodom, Hashem says he's going to destroy Sodom, and Avram doesn't stop davening for them. How come he's got 10 psukim of tefillah for the people of Sodom and no psukim of tefillah for Yitzchak? That's an interesting shaila. So Reb Schwab says, the general principle, of course, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ways are beyond our understanding. You can only daven if you think it's right. But how do you know what's right, put against what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has already said? But exceptional situations do exist in the Torah, and they're marked in a very interesting way. Hashem says, just before Avram starts to daven, he says in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Erdona ve'ere'eh. He says the people of Sodom, they've done terrible things. Erdona ve'ere'eh. I will go down and I will see what is to be done. Now this, of course, is a very difficult expression. Hashem says, I will go down. What is the meaning of that? Why can he not see from where he is? Whatever that means. And there's a whole discussion in the Rishonim, what is the meaning of the words Erdona? In what way is Hashem going down to see? And Reb Shimon Schwab explains that when Hashem prefaces by saying Erdona, he will go down, he will descend, it means in the sense that the way that he will operate here will no longer be, will not be, in the elevated and detached way that no one can fathom and no one has anything to say much about. But rather Hashem says, I will deal with them, but I'm going down to deal with them. That is to say, I'm descending to the way that people understand these things should be done. Once HaKadosh Baruch Hu has said, Erdona, I'm descending to a level that human understanding has access to in terms of how it should work and how it wouldn't work. When Avram is told that, so he understands that he's able to daven. Because if something doesn't make sense to him, normally he wouldn't say a word. Because what's the meaning of that? How can he compare what makes sense to him to what is considered correct by the infinite wisdom of Hashem? But once HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, but I'm putting myself into the way that you may think it should be done, so Avram says, well, this is how I think it should be done. And he begins to daven. That's quite a chiddush. And it happens again. In the beginning of Sefer Shemos, when Moshe has the vision by the burning bush, say Perek Gimel, so Moshe, at a certain point, I mean, many, many things are said, but at a certain point, Moshe says, you know, I'm going to come to Bnei Yisrael, and they're going to ask me what your name is. So what should I say? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says what his name will be, and that the whole, you know, one or two psukim, what is that? Etc. and so forth. But what is the meaning of Moshe saying, they'll ask me what your name is? Especially, I mean, they must know him by some name. What's the meaning of asking his name here? But HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name represents the way that he relates to the world. That's the concept of a name. Sometimes it's by the attribute of mercy, sometimes the attribute of justice, sometimes a different medium of interaction. So that means that when Moshe says that the Jewish people, when I come to them and say that you're going to deliver them, and they will ask me what your name, that means they will want to know, how is this going to work? Mashemo means, how will he be delivering us? How will this work? How will he be interacting with us? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds and tells him how it will work. But what's interesting is, why does Moshe say this? How does Moshe know that when he comes to the Jewish people, they will ask this question? How do they know that they're entitled to ask this question? Maybe they're going to be delivered, and they shouldn't ask any questions. They can ask questions at Seder night, but they're not asking questions when they're being delivered from Mitzrayim. But how do they know that they're entitled to ask this question? Moshe expects it, and has to be anticipated. Says Rav Schwab, because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe at the very beginning, I've seen the plight of my people, he says in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Ches, Vo'ered la'atzilo miyad Mitzrayim. I am now going down to save them from Mitzrayim. Says of Shimon Schwab, when Hashem says Vo'ered, I'm going down, that means, once again, this will happen in a way that people I have access to intellectually. As soon as Moshe hears Hashem is going down, with that connotation to save them, Moshe says, if they're meant to understand it, they'll demand to understand it, and they'll ask me what your name is. What shall I say? So this is a very interesting approach to the background of why we find people asking questions in the times that they do, and it all hinges on this interpretation of that very difficult word of va'ered that HaKadosh Baruch Hu uses in these situations. Now, as things develop, so the cities of Sodom and Amorah, the cities, they are destroyed. And that is described in Perek Yudtes, in Pasuk Kafdalet. Perek Yudtes, Pasuk Kafdalet. So Pasuk Kafdalet states, Vashemim Tiral Sodom, Va'ala Amorah, Gophris for Esa, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, rain down on those cities, sulfur and fire, Me'esa, Shem, and Hashemah. And, Pasuk Kafhei, because there are two aspects here. Vayafoches He'arim Ha'el. And all of these cities, we may even say these strong cities, again, He'arim Ha'el, Ha'anashim Ha'el, Ve'es Kolakikar, the whole plain, he overturned it, Vayafoch. And Rashi comments on the words Vayafoch es Ha'arim, he overturned those cities. Arba asam Yoshvos besele echad, all of these four cities, Sodom, Amora, Adma, and Svoim, they all actually were located on the same mount. And Vafochon milamalo lamata, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu overturned that entire area, and all of those cities were overturned. Now, what's interesting is, and perhaps we may have taken it for granted, but Rashi states that we know that out of the five cities, four of them were destroyed. Sodom, Amorah, Admah, Utzvoim. And Rashi mentions them here. All of them were overturned. And the truth is that this is explicit in the Pasuk later on, Parshas Nitzavim, which refers back to this event, when it says, Kema Pechas, Sodom, Amorah, Admah, Utzvoim. So, the Ma Pecha, in this context, right, that overturning affected all of those four cities. And the reason why we make a point of saying this is because look back at Pasuk Kaf Dalet. Pasuk Kaf Dalet says, Vashem himtir al Sodom va'al Amorah gofres va'esh, meis Hashem min ha-shamayim. There are two cities that are mentioned that Hashem rained down sulfur and fire over them, Sodom and Amorah. What about Admah and Tzvoim? Apparently not. Were they destroyed? Yes, all four cities were destroyed, but it seems from these two psukim that they weren't destroyed in the same way. Out of the four cities, all of them were overturned, and two of them, additionally, were burnt with gofres va'esh. And that's an interesting question, because we know, or in our understanding, is that all four of them, they were roughly equivalent to each other. Each one was as bad as the other. We wouldn't want to live in any of them. But somehow two of them, it seems, were worse than the other two. And therefore they were punished more. But where do we see this and why? And this question is raised by the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal in one of his sichas. And he explains that the answer to all of this is to be found in a Rashi earlier on. And it's amazing, because I think we could learn the Rashi a number of times and we wouldn't see what he's about to say, but as soon as he says it, it's clear. And there's actually no other way to understand the Rashi. And that's in Perek Yud Dalet Pasuk Beis. So that takes us back to Parshas Lech Lecha. Perek Yud Dalet Pasuk Beis. So this is the famous war, the four kings and the five. So the five are actually the five cities of, you know, represented by Sodom, Amorah, Admah, Tzvoim, and Tzoar. And the way the Pasuk describes it, so you have the four kings, Amraphel and his cohorts, they, Asum Chama, they waged war with whom? Well, with Bera, Melech Sodom, Bera the king of Sodom, Birsha, Melech Amorah, Shinov, Melech Admah, Shem Eber, Melech Tzvoim, and Melech Bela Hitzor. So the four kings waged war against the five. Now what's interesting is, Rashi will proceed to explain the meaning behind the names of these kings. Bera means something. It doesn't mean something very nice. And neither do any of the others. They'll have very negative connotations. And what's interesting is, even before we get to what the explanations are, what these very negative characterizations are, we ask a simple question. Rashi's job is to explain the pshat and the pasuk, not to give expositions on what someone's name might possibly mean. So why does Rashi, when it says Bera, and Rashi's going to say, oh, Bera, that's a terrible name. He's a terrible person, and that's what it means. And Birsha's even worse. Maybe that's just his name. Could be his name. How do we know that there's more to it than that? So we've mentioned in the past the fascinating insight of the Maisi Hashem. On a pshat level, these names must be characteristics, for a simple reason. If we go back to the Pasuk says, these four kings waged war against, well, who? Number one, Bera the king of Sodom. Number two, Birsha the king of Amorah. Number three, Shinov the king of Admah. Number four, Shemeva Melech Tzvoim. And number five, the king of Bela. Number five has no name. The king of Bela has no name. Did he have a name? Probably. Why don't we know it? How come the first will have a name and the fifth is just the king? But he doesn't have a name. Says the Maaseh Hashem, that's how Rashi knows that these names aren't just to tell you what their names were, because he has a name as surely as the others. But as we know, the fifth city, Tzoar, was not as bad. Of course, everything was relative, but it wasn't as bad as the others, and therefore he didn't earn for himself a negative title. So that's why he goes with no name. But that tells you that the other four are negative titles, and that's why Rashi proceeds to explain that. So when you get to the fifth king and he has no name, you look back and you see that the first four, it's more than just their name. It tells you something about them. So now, let us see what Rashi says. Bera, says Rashi, explains, Ra la Shamayim, v'ra la Brios. Bad to heaven, bad to people. That's Bera. And I think clearly, just if you look at it, how does that come out from the name? It's clearly that it's being darshan. Bera is bet ra. Two aspects of evil. Ra la Shamayim, ra la Brios. So an all-round failure. Bera. What about Birsha? Says Rashi, she nis'ale berisho. He was even worse. He was nis'ale. He was elevated in rishos, but it's the same idea. Base resha. What about Shinav? Rashi explains Shinav is sone aviv shabashamayim. He hates his father in heaven. That's Shinav. And Shem Aver, number four, some Aver. He tried to get wings, la'uf, to fly, v'likbots v'limrod b'akadosh baruch. He wanted to fly up and rebel against Hashem. Shem Aver. So these are all terrible names. But some of them are more terrible than the others. Specifically in that, if we look at the first two are found wanting both with regards to Ben Adam Lamakom and Ben Adam Lachaveyu. Bera, Rala Shemayim, Rala Bios. Birsha. So it's in both domains that they're considered to be at fault. But the second two, Shinav and Shem Aver, interestingly, but you see it if you pay attention to it, it's specifically in terms of their relationship to Hashem. Shinav, Sone Aviv Sheba Shemayim. He hates God. Does he hate people? Doesn't say. What about Shem Aver, number four? He tries to fly up and rebel against God. Does he have anything bad to do with other people? Doesn't say. Which means if we pay attention to these characterizations, we will see that Sodom and Amorah actually are different than the other two, than Admon and Tzvoim. And they're all destroyed in the end, but Sodom and Amorah are indicted on both counts, in both domains, Ben Adam Lamakom, Ben Adam Lachaveiro. Admon and Tzvoim is specifically Ben Adam Lamakom. And the way that that comes out is that when they are destroyed, they're all overturned. But Sodom and Amorah get something else. Not only are they overturned, but they're also burnt. In other words, they have that aspect of being eradicated. In the same way, Lahavdul, but very similar, that the Dor HaMabul, the generation of the flood, was wiped out and completely erased because they were so terrible, Ben Adam Lachaveiro. The Dor HaFlagah, or Dor HaPlagah, by contrast, which again wanted to build this tower, whatever that means, to wage war against Hashem, they got a milder punishment. They were scattered, but they weren't destroyed the way the Dor HaMabul was. And that difference, again, you find reflected between Sodom and Amorah on the one hand, who were eradicated, they were burnt, as opposed to Admon and Tzvoim, that were just, quote-unquote, overturned. That's what's behind it. And the whole thing is fascinating. And this comes out from those four names, as Rashi explained them. So says the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I thought perhaps to add, just as a PS, food for thought, this may explain to us something else. If we go back to our parak, Parak Yutes, so the cities are destroyed. In Pasuk Kafhei, Parak Yutes Pasuk Kafhei, Vashem himtir al Sodom v'al Amora garfris v'esh meis Hashem v'nashamayim. So that's the reference to the burning of Sodom and Amora. In Pasuk Kaftes, it states v'yihi b'shacheis elokim esarei akiko, when Hashem destroyed the cities of the plain, which refers again to all of the cities. What's very interesting is HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been mentioned by name in Pasuk Kafhei as destroying Sodom and Amorah, and in Pasuk Kaftes as destroying all of the cities, but the name has changed. In Pasuk Kafhei it says, Vashem Himtir. And in Pasuk Kaftes it says, Beshaches Elokim Esareya Kikar. What is the difference between them? Why is it that it says Hashem Himtir on Sodom and Amorah and Elokim Hafach Esareya Kikar? Well, as we know, the most straightforward differentiation between the two names, and again, their ways of relating to the world, are Midas Hadin and Midas HaRachamim. The name Elohim represents strict justice, Midas Hadin. the name of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei is the attribute of mercy. So which of these two verses now makes more sense to us? Well, they're being punished. If they're being punished, that sounds like Midas Hadin, which means that Pasuk Kaftes seems to be the intuitive choice. B'shaches Elokim, because they're being punished by Midas Hadin. That's where punishment comes from. Does punishment ever come from Midas Harachamim? That sounds like a contradiction in terms. Why would the attribute of mercy ever punish? But the Vilna Gaon says in his Perush to Megillas Rus, sometimes the attribute of mercy also punishes. If it's a crime, ben Adam Lachaveiro. And the reason why is because the mercy for the victim of those crimes also calls for punishment of the perpetrator. And therefore, I think once we understand that the overturning per se of all the four was because of a matter ben Adam Lamokum that they all had. So that's between them and Hashem, so the attribute of justice is the way that Hashem punishes them. But Sodom and Gomorrah specifically, when they're being burnt, it's that additional aspect is not because of Ben Adam Lamokum, it's Ben Adam Lachaveiro, and therefore it uses the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, that's the attribute of mercy, because the mercy that was aroused by all of the victims of Sodom and Gomorrah, that's what led to this additional aspect of punishment, and that's Vashem Imtir, of Sodom and Gomorrah. That is perhaps a possibility that would explain that shift in the use of names. Moving on to further matters in the parsha, we have Perek Kaf Aleph. The Yitzchak is born. Vashem Pokad Asaret, the Kriyas HaTorah for the first day of Rosh Hashanah. And so Avraham makes a party, and it's everyone is happy. Then it says, Vatere Sora es ben Hagar HaMitzvah. So Sora sees the son of Hagar HaMitzvah. That's Yishmael. Asher yadol l'Avraham mitzachek. So he's, well, literally, it means he's laughing. Now, actually, everyone's laughing on that occasion because Yitzchak was born. Tzachoka sole Elokim. So it was an event, it was an occasion, everyone was laughing. But apparently, Yishmael was not laughing in the right way. Rashi explains that tzachok is terrible, terrible things. All of these aviras, avodah zarah, and gilui arayos, and it's, I mean, he's a terrible influence on Yitzchak. Not all laughter is therapeutic. Some laughter is the greatest danger, if it's the disintegration of any type of value. And Yishmael's laughing. He isn't really taking life seriously. Sora says, get rid of Hagar, get rid of and her son. She doesn't even call him by name. This person will not inherit together with my son Yitzhak. Now, that's quite a harsh reaction, it seems. Whatever mitzachek means. So he's a bad influence. Apparently bad enough to provoke this reaction from Sarah. And Avram doesn't like it. The pasuk says, Avram, vayera dava ma'oda, but until Hashem intervenes and says, Sarah's right. Listen to Sarah. She's correct. The Sforno has a different explanation as to what Yishmael was laughing about. The pasuk just said he was laughing. Is there any context to know what he was laughing about? Well, actually, says the Sforno, the answer is in the verse. Because it says, Vatere Sora, es ben Hagar mitzvah. So Sora saw the son of Hagar, Asher yolda la'Avram, who she bore for Avram, he was laughing. The reason why he was laughing is because his mother bore him to Avram. That's what the laughter was about. But what is the meaning of that? We know that alongside the kosher laughter of Yitzchak's birth, where everyone was happy and it was a wonderful event, there was a very unkosher laughter. The Leitzone Hador, the scoffers of the generation. They said, Sarah and Avram, they've been married for many years, and Sarah never had children. And then she was taken by Avimelech. And then, a while later, she had a child. So they said, Mi Avimelech, Nis Avra Sarah. So she conceived through Avimelech. That's what they said. And that was the Eile told Yitzchak ben Avram, so Yitzchak's facial features were changed to look like Avram, so that kind of put it into that. But at the time, That was the joke. And that's what Yishmael is laughing about. But the question is, what's in the wings of this joke? In other words, what's attached? What's the fallout from this joke? I think normally we say, people always like something to laugh about, so, or something to scoff about, so it makes them feel good. So when she's born, they say, may I be made up the Sabrasora, so that everyone can have a laugh. But the Sforno says, no, there's much more to it than that. When Yishmael says, "Me Avimelech nis Abra Sarah," that Sarah conceived of Avimelech, he isn't just joining in on the fun with Litzoni Hador. He's laying claim as the sole heir of Avram. That's the fallout. So it's not just a joke. Because he is essentially delegitimizing Yitzchak as being connected to Avram at all. Now everyone knows that he's Avram's son. And now here's another child who's meant to be Avram's son. But if he isn't, because if we can capitalize on that joke of Me'avimelech Sabra Sara, it's I'm the only son. And that's why it was important for him to laugh at this joke. He's essentially nullifying Yitzchak as being the heir to the legacy of Avram. I'm the heir. That's why it says that she saw the son of Hagar as she yolda la Avraham. That Hagar certainly bore him to Avram. And he's saying that I'm the only one. And that's why Sarah says so he has to go. This is no longer an issue of bad influence. It's him or us. He needs to be fundamentally distant from you. And the reason why, and this the Orach Laner says in his drashas, Minchas Oni, because now when Sarah says, and the intonation changes, in Pasuk Yud, Vatomer la Avram, Garei Shama Azos Vesbana, send them all away. Why? Ki lo yirash ben Amar Azos and Bnei Yitzchak, because he will not inherit with Yitzchak. Now I think we normally understand that what that means is I am not prepared for him to inherit together with Yitzchak. That will not happen. But the Orach Laner says no. He will not be prepared to inherit together with Yitzchak, because he's delegitimizing him. The longer he stays here, the more he will push Yitzchak more and more to the side. He will not be prepared to share his inheritance with anyone, because as far as he's concerned, he has no brothers, and that's why he has to go. So Yishmael and Yitzchak, were they ever? I don't know. But in this instance, they are not a good combination. They will not do well together. And it's interesting. The Tanchuma tells us that in the beginning of Parshas Chayei Sarah, so when Avram comes, L'spod L'sarah V'levkosa, he comes to give a hesped for Sarah, comes to eulogize her. What's the eulogy? Well, Pasuk doesn't say. But the Tanchuma says it was Eishes Chayil. Avram was the first one to say the song of Eishes Chayil, which later on then became written down as part of Mishlei. But the first Eishes Chayil was Avram's hesped for Sarah. And in fact, the Tanchuma goes on to explain how some of these verses relate to the life of Sarah. And then it gets to Darshat Semer Ufishtim. Darshat Semer Ufishtim. That's when she sent Yishmael away. That's Darshat Semer Ufishtim. Now, what's that got to do with Darshat Semer Ufishtim? So we understand that Darsha means that she seeks after these materials to because she's very industrious, and Darshat Semer Ufishtim. But the Tanchuma says Darshat Semer Ufishtim means she darshaned Semer Ufishtim. She expounded the concept of wool and linen. That is to say, wool and linen cannot be together. They are shatnas. They will bring out the worst in each other. And therefore Yishmael has to go. And what's interesting is, there was already a pre-run of Semer Ufishtim in the history of the world. The very first Shatner's combination, which went terribly wrong, was Cain and Hevel. Cain, he brought korbanos from the ground. Rashi says from the flax of the ground, that was his korban. And Hevel, haya roetzon, and he brought it from the sheep, with the wool of the sheep. That's Semer Ufishtim. And Pishtim killed Semer. And the Tanchuma says she looked at that episode and she saw it was about to happen again. Darshat Semer Ufishtim, she said, Yishmael's got to go. The flax has got to go. And it's a very interesting approach to this section of the Torah, because not only does it shed light on what happened, but of course, it's still happening. That's Yishmael who's not prepared to inherit together with Yitzhak. That's Mamish, that's Maisa Ovis, Simen Labon. I'd just like to conclude by referring to a portion of the Akedah where Avram he's been stopped from killing Yitzhak, and then he sees this aisle. It's a Perek Kaf Beis. Perek Kaf Beis Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayisa Avram es Einov. Vayar v'nei aisle. So he sees this ram achar nechaz basvach bekarnav. It's entangled in the thicket. Vayelech Avram ikachas aisle. Vayalelo tachas benu. And he offers it as a korban. Vayikra Avram Shem Amokamo, and then he renames the place, or he names the place Hashem Yireh. That's the beginning of the first one to name. Asher Yomer Hayom Behar Hashem Yireh. That it should be said that Hashem will be seen on the mountain. That's slightly obscure, certainly needs to be understood. But he does name the place. Now what's unique, or very special, more correctly, about this aisle, it's on an interesting list. Or more correctly, it's on an interesting addendum to a list. Because the Mishnah tells us in the fifth parak of Pirkei Avos that there were 10 things that were created Erev Shabbos bin Hashmashos. Some of them, of course, we know very well, the rainbow and the etc. And then the Yesh Omrim, some add on two things. Eilo shel Avram, this ram of Avram that he brought as a korban, ukvorosa shel Moshe. And the burial place of Moshe. That's the addition. And Rosh Shlomo Kluger, in his Peirush Magen Avos to Pirkei Avos, so he's wondering, in terms of this addition, you've got these two things, and they're added on. Some say also these two things. Are they connected to each other at all? Or are they just connected in that each of them is added onto the list of 10? It's an interesting siruf. It's an interesting combination of things. They're two things that, outside of this Mishnah, I don't know if we've ever put them together. It's hardly a natural association. When you think of the ram of Avram, what does that bring to mind? It will not bring to mind the burial of Moshe. And still the Mishnah puts them together. Says Rav Shlomo Kluger, because they are connected. How so? Avram's prayer is, Behar Hashem Yeiro'eh. Hashem shall always be there on the mountain. Now, what does that mean? And what's special about this mountain? Well, as we know, I mean, this mountain is Har HaBayis. This is Har HaMoriah. But now the Shaila is, which the Medrash asks, but why is he davening that Hashem should be there on the mountain? I mean, what's special about Har HaMoriah? That's where the Beis HaMikdash was. So davening that Hashem should always be there in the Beis HaMikdash. Why Behar Hashem Yeiro'eh? And the Medrash says, because Avram saw that the house won't always be there. The Beis HaMikdash won't always be there. And what he's davening is that even when the Beis HaMikdash isn't there, and it's just a mountain, Hashem will still be there. Says Rav Shlomo Kluger, it seems that there's a further point here. Not only is Avram saying that even if the Beis HaMikdash should be destroyed, and it's only a mountain, Hashem should be there, but actually Avram is davening that if there may be circumstances where it should be turned back into a mountain, and Hashem will be there. He's actually davening that under certain circumstances, the house should be removed. Why would he daven that it should turn back into a mountain? Behar Hashem Yeiro'eh. Well, the Medrash tells us that to a certain degree, and it's a broader discussion, but we're familiar with this statement of Chazal, Mizmor LeDavid. It was a comfort in a way that Hashem vented his anger on the Beis HaMikdash and not on the Jewish people. So better that it should go than they should go. Kila HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chamaso al Eitzim Va'avonim. So to speak, he vented his anger on sticks and stones and not on the Jewish people. And that explains how there could be a situation that it would be considered a positive result for the Beis HaMikdash should be destroyed. And if it's the Beis HaMikdash or us, better it should become a mountain. That's what Avram is davening for. Now the question is, if the Beis HaMikdash isn't destroyed, who will suffer? There are always going to be people on a higher level, people on a lower level. The people on a higher level don't warrant destruction. It's the lower echelons. They're the ones who are in danger. So this now is Avram's choice. And all of the Abbas have this choice. And they have different middos. But the choice is, do you stay with the higher level at the expense of the lower level? Or do you try and include as many people as possible? And what does the future of the Jewish people look like? Does it look like it's a large nation, including many people who are not really pulling their weight, but they are Jewish? Is that the ideal? Is that the better shape of the Jewish people? Or maybe they should be cut away, and only those that make the grade? In Avram, and if they do that, the Beis HaMikdash is there to stay. Because they'll never descend to a level that it would need to be destroyed. So you've got the higher level with the Beis HaMikdash, or the larger Jewish, the greater Jewish people, sometimes without the Beis HaMikdash. That's the choice of Avram. And it's not an easy choice. And that's why, says Rav Shlomo Kluger, the ram that precipitated this prayer was caught in a thicket. Nechaz basvach, it was stuck. Because Avram had to think about whether or not he wanted to bring it. Whether he wanted to unravel it and actually offer it and proceed with this. But he did. Because Avram's midah is midah sachesed. And therefore his heart goes out to all of his descendants. Even if that means that at a certain point the house needs to turn into a mountain. Bahar Hashem Yeroeh. How does this affect other matters? The Medrash tells us that had Moshe entered Eretz Yisrael and built the Beis HaMikdash, it could never have been destroyed. That's endemic in the nature of the things that Moshe engages in. And it's exactly for that reason that when the Jewish people were not up to par as they were entering Eretz Canaan, that's the underlying reason why Moshe is not allowed to enter Eretz Canaan and he dies in the Midbar. And therefore, says Rav Shlomo Kluger, you understand, and it's an amazing thing to say it this way, but when Avram is davening that Hashem should be on the mountain, that means he's davening that if necessary, the Beis HaMikdash should be destroyed, which means he's davening if necessary, Moshe should be buried in Chutz La'aretz, in the Midbar, and not enter Eretz Canaan. And that's why the Mishnah puts these two things together, the ram of Avram and the burial of Moshe, because the ram of Avram, when Avram chose to go that way, ultimately led to the burial of Moshe. So these are fascinating insights, and certainly the more we ponder the words of Chazal, these lists and the two additions to the list through the great Mefarshim, Rishonim and Achronim, the more we emerge. Baruch Hashem Gadol. We'll leave it over there for this evening.